dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Man, we turn to with regularity for his intelligence on so many topics is David Goldman. He is better known perhaps by his byname Spengler at Asia Times, where he contributes marvelously to the public policy debate about what is going on with China and Asia more generally. He is also the author of a terrific new book, You Will Be Assimilated, about China Sino-forming the world. It's great to have you with us, David. As always, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. I wanted to pick up on a piece that you actually had in a different publication, tabletmag.com, recently, entitled Empire of Emperors. What is China, and why should you worry about it? If you could, give us a short précis of this really important piece, David.
China is not a nation state, Frank. It doesn't have a sense of combined loyalty and national purpose. It is an assembly of 200 languages, 80 ethnic groups, which are held together by the ambition of the people it selects for its elite. Run by a Mandarin bureaucracy. It has been for 2,500 years. The Communist Party operates on the same principle. Study massively past the college entrance exam, get seated out into a top position, get powerful and rich. So China is a seething mass of personal ambition. I call it an empire of emperors because every Chinese is a wannabe emperor. And we happen to have the interesting circumstance to be born at a moment where this 5,000-year-old entity has said, we can now look out to the world and reassert ourselves as the dominant power and get our place in the sun. After this brief unpleasantness of the century of humiliation where the Western powers and the Industrial Revolution humiliated us.
This is essentially returning to the Middle Kingdom role that they've long thought was their due. And it's very interesting, David, because last night, of course, we were treated to a very short course on foreign policy in what was supposed to be a debate about it. It was largely preoccupied with other things, of course. But I'd be interested in your take on what Joe Biden in particular said about how he was going to deal with China, given what you've just described as its ambitions, which are rather chilling. But he's quite confident that he would be able to compel the Chinese to play by the international rules, as he put it. What are your thoughts about that?
Biden's constituency is the American tech industry, which is now the majority of wealth in the U.S., majority of stock market capitalization. These are the people who deindustrialized the United States, made a decision that the manufacturing should go to Asia while we do the software. That's Facebook, Microsoft, Google, the liberal elite embodied in the tech industry. They don't want to fight China. They want into China. They want a bigger chunk of the Chinese market. What people close to Biden have been saying, including the whole range of former Obama officials and other top Democratic Party leaders whom we've spoken to, is that Biden will negotiate. Biden will say, okay, you know, Trump has turned the screws on technological controls. If you want us to let up, give some concessions to American tech companies and give them a bigger share of your home market. What Biden wants is what the people have called Chimerica, a recoupling of the U.S. and Chinese economies, but on terms that are more favorable to his business constituency.
One of the things that I was struck by, David, in reflecting on this comment of his, is that Joe Biden, as you know, back in 2013, was instrumental when he had the China portfolio in the Obama-Biden administration for the negotiation of a bilateral memorandum of understanding between the two countries that essentially allowed the Chinese not to play by our rules. I'm not talking about international rules. I'm talking about our own rules, our own laws and securities regulations specifically, so as to have access to our capital markets without having to comply with accounting standards, transparency, governance arrangements, material risk disclosure, and the like. If that's playing, you know, on terms more favorable to us, I'm a little unclear how that's working out for investors, but it certainly seems to be detrimental, as we'll be talking about shortly with Grant Newsom. If you're looking at the underwriting through our capital markets of some of the worst of the Chinese behavior and ambitions.
Well, Frank, the way the Chinese look at it is, we're the empire, everyone should come to us. If you accept our terms, we'll give you crumbs off the table. We'll let you be part of the empire too. They're not the Romulans or the Klingons, they're the Borg. We want your DNA. We want to assimilate you. So, for example, in China, Huawei and ZTE don't dominate the 5G. They dominate the 5G rollout, but they also give a big market share to Ericsson. Nokia has its biggest R&D operation in the world in China. They want the foreign inputs. And the same is going to be true of American financial firms who are very active in China, and the tech companies want into China. And China's a top Chinese executive told me there are two ways this can go. One is we wipe out the U.S. tech companies, none of them survive. The other is they accept a certain amount of market share, they work with us, and they can still make a living. Which do you want?
The analogy which you've used on this program before, and I know in your book, to the Borg, is apt, it seems to me. As in Star Trek, it's a rather threatening adversary. They want your DNA, yes, but they're going to use it as part of their larger plan to take over.
Absolutely. They want to be the center. They want to make the rules. They want to dictate who gets what market share and who makes what money. But the Chinese have always had the approach, if you kowtow to the emperor, if you assimilate, we'll let you make a living. We won't annihilate you. That's the Chinese approach. And U.S. tech companies all want to take that deal.
Here's the thing. One of the efforts that we've been making, as I think you know, at the Committee on the Present Danger, China, is to reach out to and work with and help those who have been enslaved by the Chinese Communist Party. And I think they would be the first to tell you whether they're Tibetans or whether they're Southern Mongolians or whether they're Manchurians or whether they're Uyghurs in East Turkestan, that this submission business is not a bowl of cherries. They may let you survive. They may let you, you know, eat, shall we say. But this is not an enviable life, especially if you've in the past enjoyed freedom and, you know, sovereign nation. So this is a subject to which we will return with you, David Goldman, because it is arguably the most important of our time. And whether we will assimilate, as they have in mind, as you say in your book, you will be assimilated, that is, or whether we will remain free and sovereign is what's up for grabs at the moment. And hopefully we'll be advanced in the decision in the right direction by this election. Thank you for your time today, my friend. Come back to us again next week, if you would. Next up, we will speak with Colonel John Mills. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back, and I'm especially pleased that we are able to catch up briefly with a colleague that I've come to admire greatly. He is a member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, a retired colonel in the United States Army who was deeply involved in psychological operations and other black arts. He is a former senior executive of the Defense Department on the civilian side of the house, and he had responsibilities for cyber warfare operations, among other things, while at DOD. His name is Colonel John Mills, United States Army retired, and I'm very pleased always to have a chance to pick his brain about a couple of things, including one that is of surpassing importance as we look to a potentially quite fraught transition of power coming up. He's a prime feature in an expose that our friend Sam Faddis recently ran at And Magazine, and I'll ask John to talk a little bit about it. John, it's good to have you with us again. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Well, so tell us about some of your experiences while you were at the Defense Department, specifically in the run-up to the inauguration of Donald Trump.
Yes, Frank. So I was in the Office of Secretary of Defense at senior levels. I had to work very closely with the Obama appointees. Things really started to turn sinister in 2010, but we'll jump right to the critical events of after the election, what happened. And I just, you know, I do have 25 pages in front of Durham. I had to make an amendment when this came out, but Ratcliffe has been able to extrude out two critical data points that essentially corroborate all my information.
This is John Ratcliffe, of course, the Director of National Intelligence, who has been turning over a lot of rocks lately.
Yeah, absolutely. This has been so critical because now we potentially have a crime. It's no longer a difference of opinion, different viewpoints on policy. So what he identified, two critical things, was first, Comey and Brennan knew in July and September the Russia story was a hoax perpetrated by the Clinton campaign. That's now fact. The second thing is, as soon as the election didn't go a certain way, they initiated, and I was involved in this, they initiated what's called an intel community assessment to essentially finalize the Russian narrative. I reviewed that package, and so now we've established they knew it was a hoax. They ran an intel community assessment package that was a hoax. That is a fraudulent action. That's 18 U.S. Code. I think it's Section 1001. That is a false statement by a federal official. They had so dozens of senior staff officers, and everybody's a staff officer in the Pentagon, no matter what your rank, ran a fraudulent action. We didn't know it. So I non-concurred with that package. The body did not support the conclusion. And I was told, slightly paraphrasing, Secretary of Defense, it was Ash Carter at the time, is going to go ahead and sign this. We don't even have to complete the package. And I was told the reason he's signing it was because Comey and Brennan were personally working the cover memo, which is absolutely unprecedented.
And so just to recap, this was an assessment of the whole thesis that there was Russian interference in the election of 2016 and sort of set the predicate for the contention that there was collusion between the Trump administration or the Trump campaign, I should say, at the time with the Russians to that end. Is that right?
That is absolutely correct. And now the circle is closed. They ran an intel community assessment. This is a huge official action that is assumed to be correct as a false thing. Now on November 10th, and this is part of the story, I was called on the classified phone and I was asked by a senior career official, but they were giddy with excitement. John, we need you to participate in an IPC, a series of meetings being set up at the White House to finalize the Russian story and plan for a potential delay of President Trump's inauguration. This is unprecedented in American history. And when I got that call, I'm going, oh my, I don't want anything to do with this. So this is the same group that ran and created that package. And I did not participate in those meetings. I thought this was insanity, but the top secret emails were flying back and forth on it. And I was still left on all the email chains. And they called me back a number of times on the classified phone asking for my participation. I did review the intel community assessment, which now has been factually established as fraudulent.
You have reported that one of the purposes of this exercise was actually to prevent the inauguration of Donald Trump, having failed to prevent him from getting elected in the first place, having failed to scupper him completely during the transition. They were apparently intent on preventing him from being sworn in and becoming the actual president of the United States. Is that right?
That is correctly. This was a coup. This was a conspiracy. And you know, Rich Higgins just came out with a book, but he was at the White House early at, so the inauguration did proceed, but there was many things that I was seeing that he was seeing from another side while I was at DOD, one of the lead agencies in this conspiracy. And there were many careerists giddy with, I'll use that term, giddy with excitement to help the former administration. The morning after the election, I'll never forget it, I was walking down the hall and I ran into, I can't say the name, but a very senior person who would have been the director of NSA if the election had gone the other way. And he was shell-shocked. I mean, he was, if you've ever seen somebody in combat shell-shocked, he was shell-shocked. And we talked for a while. That person, I can't name that person, had not come up in public as being one of these named people of interest, but this person was very involved in this whole episode. They were shocked that they would have become the director of NSA, which would have put them on top of the critical data sets for things like the end or, you know, the use of the Five Eyes program to do spying on Americans, but in a lawful way because it was shared from our Five Eyes partners.
Yeah, these are the Brits, the Australians, the New Zealanders, and the Canadians that make up our most trusted intelligence partners, and the British intelligence services implicated deeply in this effort to take down Donald Trump. As you say, technically, legally, enabling the CIA to spy on a domestic political candidate and campaign when it otherwise would not have been allowed to do so. So talk a little bit about what the practical effect would have been were they to have succeeded in waylaying or perhaps scotching altogether the transfer of power from Barack Obama to Donald Trump, as mandated by the election of 2016.
Yeah, you know me, Frank. I am just a fountain of historical knowledge, and there's no precedent to this. This was a coup. This is insanity. I cannot think of any precedent. And I've been, over my 35 plus years, involved in some very interesting situations that have never really come to light in the world. And I've never seen anything like this. I don't even know where to begin. This was a coup.
So we dodged that bullet, but yet we've seen in the intervening years the coup continue in various other forms. They've ultimately recoiled from the idea of the deferred or sabotaged inauguration, John Mills, but of course they went on to impeachment and to successive efforts with the 25th Amendment and so on. You talk about historical precedent. I'm really struck by how much Donald Trump has accomplished despite all of this in the nearly 4 years of his presidency. One can only imagine what he might have gotten done had he actually had an administration that was working for him, as opposed to very substantially working to try to take him down. Having been inside the belly of the beast, if you could, very quickly, sort of give us a flavor of this deep state quality and what it has meant to this presidency and to the country.
Yeah, you know, I think an exemplar moment was in July of 2016, right before the convention, in the halls of the Pentagon, I ran into a former Bush official, a very senior Bush official, who I really admired and was a mentor to me. And I asked them, so you're going to support Donald Trump, right? So this person was a Republican, was part of the Bush administration. Said, you're going to support Trump, right? That's the answer. And his response, I kid you not, was, no, we see more opportunities with her. And it just jolted me. I got right in their face. I said, who is we and what opportunities do you see? And from that point onward, I knew we were at war. We were at war with a deep state.
There's so much more to talk with you about all of this, John, and we will do so, I hope, in the days to come, because it's vital that people understand, really, the character of what has happened to our country and to its government during this period in which whatever one wants to call it, the deep state is the common term these days, as we discussed with Rich Higgins yesterday on television program Securing America. It's pernicious and it is unaccountable and it is dangerous. And hopefully one of the upshots of this election will be draining the swamp. Thank you, John Mills. God bless you for your service to our country, which continues these days. And we'd like to thank particularly here at Secure Freedom Radio and over at Securing America. Join us again soon. I hope the rest of you will continue listening as we turn our attention to what might be in store for our nuclear deterrent should Joe Biden become the next president of the United States. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's a pleasure to say, as always, when we have the chance to visit with Peter Vincent Pry, that we have in the house virtually, that is, one of the great experts on national security matters, particularly some that are not getting the attention that they deserve. This has been Peter's lot in life. He was a CIA analyst. He worked on the House Armed Services Committee staff. He has staffed and led several important commissions created by the Congress to study deeply such issues as electromagnetic pulse and nuclear deterrent forces. In connection with the first, he's written a number of books, extraordinarily important works on the threat of EMP, as it's known, including most recently a chronicle of the really remarkable contributions of the Congressional EMP Threat Commission entitled The Power and the Light. Peter Pry, it's always so good to have you with us, as I say, but especially at the moment, because there's some big things happening and we need your insight. So welcome back.
Well, thank you so much, Frank. And I violently agree that national security issues have been really neglected in the election, and yet they're the most important issues of all for the survival of America.
The foreign policy debate last night scarcely mentioned foreign policy. I think with hardly an exception, it was neglected in favor of, it seemed, a whole bunch of domestic issues and primarily issues on which President Trump would be on the defense and Joe Biden would be on the offense, I guess, in keeping with the practices of the so-called debate commission to date. But Peter, let's talk about one of the issues that really should be getting a lot more attention than it is. Our nuclear deterrent forces have, as you have done as much as anybody to document, are in a rather parlous state. We have not engaged in the kind of routine systemic modernization that we should have for many years. There is, though, an even more worrying emerging prospect that Joe Biden, were he to be elected president, would begin dismantling unilaterally such forces as we do have. What light can you shed on this?
Sure. I think the best indicator of what a future Biden administration policy toward our nuclear forces is going to be is what the House Democrats have been wanting to do in the House Armed Services Committee. You know, it's the most important position they have currently in terms of our defense establishment, you know, domination of the House Armed Services Committee. And almost as soon as they won the 2018 elections, in March 2019, they had hearings that called for basically unilaterally reducing the U.S. nuclear triad, abolishing U.S. ICBMs.
Those are intercontinental ballistic missiles.
Yes. And cutting in half the future number of ballistic missile submarines that we plan to have from 12 to 6. And this was headed up by the, you know, Bruce Blair was one of the chief spokesmen for this, him and other people from that, like the Federation of American Scientists and Union of Concerned Scientists, who are notorious far-left nuclear disarmament activists. And basically, Adam Smith was on board with all that. He was a convert to their views. He's the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. And so the person who had to have their top experts, and mind you, and you know this, Frank, because you served in administrations, when a new administration comes in, they typically draw their staff and expertise from congressional staff. So the people who put on this hearing, who believed in this hearing, and were promoting these extremely dangerous policies for unilaterally dismantling the U.S. nuclear triad and going down to just 6 ballistic missile submarines. And by the way, if you had only 6 ballistic missile submarines, that would enable you to only have 2 at sea on a day-to-day basis to protect against a surprise attack.
Peter, let's talk about this in a way that I think most of us can get our heads around. The various elements of this so-called nuclear triad have competing, or complementary, I guess one might say, attributes, both positive and negative. And it's the synergy of them that has caused us over the years to have confidence that we could, in fact, deter adversaries from thinking they could successfully attack us, presumably in a sort of surprise bolt from the blue undertaking. So just walk through quickly what some of those attributes are and why the unilateral elimination of one of those triad legs, as they call it, the ICBM force, would be so detrimental to our deterrent posture.
Sure. Taking a 20,000 foot view of the triad, I think it's important to understand that the triad was conceived and developed by the great generation that had survived in one World War II. And at the beginning of World War II, the best laid plans of the Allies catastrophically failed. You know, the Maginot Line failed. We didn't have a blitzkrieg strategy, so the way we used our tanks failed. Our torpedoes didn't even work in World War II at the beginning. And we were just able to win the Battle of Midway, because of the dive bombers. So they knew that things go wrong in war. And that's the most important thing about the triad, because it has these mutually reinforcing systems so that just in case things go wrong in a nuclear war, and a lot can go wrong in a nuclear war, you've got a safety net in each of these legs of the triad. And each of them has different characteristics that, as you noted, reinforce each other. The bombers, for example, are the only part of the triad that can be recalled, and you can use them for conventional as well as nuclear operations. But they're the most vulnerable part to a surprise attack, because we only have 3 bomber bases, they're not on alert, and they don't normally carry nuclear weapons. And so even North Korea could wipe out the bomber force, you know, with just 3 warheads targeted on the bomber bases. Nonetheless, the flexibility of the bombers being able to do conventional as well as nuclear operations and the fact that you can call them back are extremely valuable characteristics that no other part of the triad has. The ICBMs are our best defense against surprise attack that old Cold Warriors like me think is the most likely nuclear scenario you're likely to encounter, that an enemy is going to try to hit you by surprise, the way the Japanese did at Pearl Harbor, for example. And the ICBMs, that's why they maintain a very high alert rate. They're constantly ready to be launched in just a few minutes to deter an adversary from thinking that he'll be able to get away with a surprise attack so we could launch on warning.
And there are a substantial number of them, too. So a surprise attack would take an enormous amount of incomings to do the job, no?
That's right. It's a misconception that the ballistic missile submarines are the most survivable part of the triad. The ICBMs are the hardest to destroy because there's 400 ICBM silos, hardened silos. So an enemy would have to launch hundreds of weapons, at least 400, in order to take out the ICBM force. The ballistic missile submarine force in a surprise attack scenario, 2/3 of them are located in just 2 ports.
And are there typically in the course of an ordinary day, right? So only a few are at sea at any given time, as you said earlier. And if you're down to half that number from 12 to 6, that's a very, very tiny percentage and a very attractive target for, as you say, surprise military operations. We know adversaries like the Russians in particular have been seriously pursuing anti-submarine warfare capabilities. I think the Chinese as well. So the vulnerability of those submarines may be higher, as you point out, and a really important piece that you published recently at the Washington Times. It could be something we're surprised profoundly about in the event somebody decides to go to war with us. No?
Yes, even North Korea could take out 2/3 of the U.S. ballistic missile submarine fleet with just 2 warheads. Now, those ballistic missile submarines that are at sea, the Navy will say, you know, are more survivable than ICBMs. But as you noted, Russia and probably China, I mean, they've been working for decades on ways to go after those submarines. And in fact, Russia next year is planning to deploy a special weapon called Poseidon, which is probably specifically designed to take out our submarines. You know, this is a autonomous robot submarine that's carry a 100-megaton warhead. You know, if that thing could follow our ballistic missile submarines around, you know, a 100-megaton warhead, the shockwave from that, the underwater shockwave would reach out over 100 kilometers. So you don't even have to get all that close to be able to take out a submarine. And if you only got 2 submarines at sea, they're going to have 32 of these Poseidons out there that could be hunting our subs. And if Joe Biden reduces the ballistic missile submarine fleet to just 2 on a day-to-day basis, well, that's not a credibly survivable deterrent. And besides, the submarines were never intended really to be used in a warfighting mode. The submarines' survivability, put quotes around that, they're supposed to be a secure reserve to deter enemy attacks on our cities. They're sort of a last-ditch defense so that if everything goes wrong, at least we can save our cities, keeping their cities at risk. So you're not even supposed to be using them in a normal, you know, counterforce, warfighting type exchanges. In effect, what Democrats have done is they've embraced the far-left view that we can get by with a minimum nuclear deterrent. Just threaten to blow up their cities with a handful of submarines and a very small number of nuclear weapons, and everything will be fine. Well, that defies all of military history because it assumes that nothing will go wrong.
Peter, we're going to return to this topic with you, I hope, in the near future, because it warrants much, much more serious scrutiny. Appreciate you bringing it to the attention of our audience in the run-up to this election, because an awful lot is on the line in this area, as in so many others. I know you'll keep up the great work you do, Peter, at the National Security and Homeland Security Task Force, and we are very appreciative of your visits with us from time to time. Come back to us again soon. Next up, we'll speak with Grant Newsom about that Chinese threat to Taiwan most immediately, perhaps, and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and we're joined by one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio. He is, in fact, a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy. He is also a senior research fellow for the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies. He is retired United States Marine Corps Colonel Grant Newsom, an international businessman as well as a very accomplished military officer, and we're delighted to have him with us always. Grant Newsom, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio, as I say. I wanted to talk to you today, Grant, about the seeming intensifying belligerence of the Chinese Communist Party and their military, the People's Liberation Army, towards Taiwan, both at the rhetorical level, but also, it seems, increasingly in terms of forward-deployed and quite capable military assets and dual-use ones. How would you characterize the state of the CCP threat to Taiwan at the moment?
Militarily, I would suggest that if China wanted to attack Taiwan and have a reasonable chance of winning in a certain sense, they could do it.
Could do it now from a standing start, would you say?
They could come pretty close to that. certainly to get these small offshore islands from Taiwan, that could be done literally from a standing start, but also even for a larger assault on it, that maybe not a standing start, but they have really got the pieces in place, and more importantly, they have the capabilities to do it. There's always been a tendency on our side to say, well, they're not quite there yet, or it's going to take a while, and amphibious operations are hard, therefore the Chinese could never master them. Well, that we've underestimated the Chinese over and over, but they, if you look at the PLA's, the People's Liberation Army's capabilities, they have put together a force, and not just an amphibious force, but it combines rockets, electronic warfare, cyber missiles, undersea warfare, naval capabilities. They've really put together a comprehensive force designed to attack and seize Taiwan.
Now, you've obviously served in our Marine Corps and are intimately familiar with the challenges of amphibious operations and combined arms and trying to project power over bodies of water, notably the Chinese Taiwan Strait, for example. Given that this is, to some extent, a function not just of capabilities, the ability, that is to say, to pull these kinds of operations off, but of experience, of training, of actually performing these things under realistic circumstances, would you say that the Chinese have got that box checked as well, or not?
You know, I think they have it at least checked in pencil. Maybe a number one pencil, and good training and practice will get you a long ways. And we often hear that said, well, they don't have experience at amphibious operations. Well, we don't have experience at it either when it comes to major ones. But we underestimate the Chinese capabilities. One might say if you look back 50, 60 years, they've had some good practice at it, starting in the time of the Chinese Civil War. And say good training will get you a long ways. Would they find it a challenge? Yes, of course, everybody would. But in terms of their ability to master what is required for a large-scale amphibious assault, the Chinese are as capable, and I would suggest more capable than just about anyone. And we underestimate them at our peril. Would they actually attack? Of course. I think they'd prefer not to. And that's why you see the constant intimidation, subversion, the vitriolic language, blood-curdling coming from the Chinese side towards Taiwan and towards us if we help Taiwan. And they would prefer to have Taiwan go quietly. They would prefer to have the Americans let Taiwan and encourage Taiwan to go quietly into the arms of the CCP, Chinese Communist Party.
And we've heard on that blood-curdling rhetoric line that Xi Jinping, the general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party and the dictator of China, actually calling on his Marines to get ready for war. So this is what I would think in the intelligence business would be considered an indicator and warning of what's afoot. But when you put this all together, Grant Newsom, what do you make of the sort of countervailing capabilities of the United States and now those that it's been recently exercising with other members of the so-called Quad, Japan, where you are based, Australia, and India, especially importantly. Are we now seeing a greater deterrent being put into place to these Chinese ambitions and capabilities as well?
Potentially, yes. And it's always worth remembering that the U.S. military, you know, for all the challenges it's faced and the 20 years of strategic floundering in the Middle East, it's still, the Americans are still not chopped liver, or which means they've got a punch, and the Chinese know it. We just need to make it more of one. Having the Japanese, the Australians, and the Indians more overtly sort of join up with us in the form of the so-called Quad is a good thing. You put their resources together, and we've got even more of a punch. But also beyond the military, there's the political sort of unity in challenging China, or better said, in standing up for the free world's interests. That is probably as significant as the military aspect, but you do have to have actual military capability. And then if they can make the Quad into an economic sort of force. That too, if you look at it from China's perspective, that's not what you want to see, is your strongest allies getting together, psychologically not least.
Grant, I guess what I'm interested in as much as anything is, as you see this as a serious strategist and retired military leader, what must we be doing now that we aren't so much to try to increase the disincentives to China for taking over this part of the free world? And I'm so glad you used that term because I think it's relevant here. Having just gobbled up Hong Kong, seems to have whetted their appetite and encouraged the Chinese leadership to believe they could pull off even something more audacious and destructive of the free world's interests. Your thoughts on what else we should be doing to try to discourage that?
Well, we do have to get the military part right, and that means you've got to get your naval capabilities, your sort of the full range of capabilities that you can take on the Chinese strengths and effectively neutralize them. And that's why I hope we've got some really smart guys at work on some of the new weapons that we always seem to pull out just when we need them. But you do need to make Taiwan a very tough nut to crack, and at the same time, be able to not just sort of fight just face-to-face in Taiwan, but to apply pressure from all different directions against the PRC should it go after Taiwan. And that really requires the ability to really shut down their foreign trade everywhere. But other places to give ourselves better odds and to preserve freedom really is to apply financial pressure on the People's Republic of China and make the cost so high to the leaders of the CCP, not the average Chinese, because the Chinese leaders will let the masses absorb any amount of punishment, but make it direct so they feel it directly with their overseas real estate, bank accounts, and green cards, and be willing to, say, apply pressure on different fronts, not just militarily, but economically and financially. And as we've talked about before, sometimes, so at some point, Wall Street and the American financial community and Silicon Valley are going to have to decide whether they prefer concentration camps and organ harvesting, or if they prefer the liberties that we have. And it is about that stark choice. And it's just astonishing to see their willingness to tolerate what goes on in the People's Republic of China.
Worse than tolerate, to enable it.
Well, they're funding our enemies. There's no other way to put it. That's got to stop. Otherwise, we can do all the military things we want. But if easily understands the problem. You have someone who says they want to fight and kill you and kill your friends. And you're on our side. We're trying to get our military ready, trying to get allies organized. And then our financial class is funding the other side.
Grant, we have to finish with that thought. This is a vital, vital point, and we will return to it with you very soon, I hope, because I can't think of one more important to dissuading the Chinese from acts of aggression than cutting off their life support for doing just that. Bless you, sir. Thank you for the great work you do, both with us and with the Japanese Forum. And I know you will keep it up, and I hope you will come back to us soon, as I do the rest of you. Come back to us, I hope, on Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.